Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Breaking Bad Habits, Defy Industry Norms, and Reinvigorate Your Business by Freek Vermolen. Narrated by Liam Gerard. Publisher's note: this audiobook has bonus material. Please contact whomever you purchased this audiobook from to request the material. All figures, tables, and illustrations referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. Preface. Organizations are great. I love them. Not just because I make a living studying them, but because they are the true building blocks of human life. Organizations have produced or affected pretty much everything we touch, eat, wear, and see. They achieve and construct things that no individual could make, or sometimes even imagine. However, organizations are also filled with practices, habitual ways of doing things that are sometimes inefficient and bureaucratic, and that make our blood boil. Sometimes these inefficient practices and strategies spread and persist for decades or even longer. They persist, just like viruses persist in nature. They take on lives of their own and continue operating, despite leading to suboptimal results in the companies that embody them. The good news is that smart managers can purposefully identify and eradicate them, and then turn them into a profitable source of renewal and innovation. That is what this book is about. Introduction. Fertile Ground. Some years ago in London, I met a doctor who worked at an in vitro fertilisation, IVF, clinic. After telling me about his field and the shape of the industry in the United Kingdom, he immediately and vigorously started discussing what he and others in the industry referred to as the League Table, a government-mandated and publicly accessible website with information on all the IVF clinics in the UK that the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority compiles and publishes annually. Since the website included information on each clinic's success rate, people had started treating it as a ranking. The website was an admirable attempt to increase transparency and influence consumer behaviour. Since most clinics in the UK are private, although there are a fair number of National Health Service clinics too, and the procedure is expensive, the idea was to empower patients to go online, study the information, and make better choices about their medical care. Even better, the reported success rates were based on objective data. In many businesses, you can debate whether something is a success or a partial failure, and so on, but not in IVF. The percentage of births that result from treatment is clear-cut. Either patients get pregnant, or they don't. Therefore, the League Table was intended to be good for both patients and clinics. The best clinics were rewarded for their high success rates, and patients were empowered to seek out the best practitioners. But there was a problem that well-intentioned politicians had overlooked. A clinic's success rate is not only driven by how skilled it is at performing the IVF procedure, but is also affected by the quality of the input, or the women who walk through the doors. Physiologically, some women are more receptive to IVF treatment than others, so a clinic's success rate is heavily weighted by the age, health, and fertility of the women it accepts as patients. For example, a clinic that only accepts women who are in their early 20s and are fertile, have never before undergone in vitro treatments, and have ample eggs that can be freshly harvested, as they say in the industry, would have high success rates. Whereas a clinic that also treats women in their 40s, who have unsuccessfully tried in vitro treatments in the past, and only have a handful of eggs left over in the freezer from previous treatments, would probably have lower success rates. This was a problem. Since the success rates were measured and publicised so widely and were known to influence consumer behaviour, some clinics began to change their selection criteria to maximise their rankings. They practised what I call selection at the gate, after the Dutch expression selecte aan de poort. They purposely gravitated toward easier and more probable cases while avoiding more complicated ones. And this became a best practice in the industry. Despite the short-term boost, selection at the gate wasn't good for anyone involved. Doctors and clinic administrators felt as if they were stuck between economics and education. As one doctor told me, if your motivation for doing the job is to help patients or to expand your horizon scientifically, then, actually, you will choose to work in a clinic that is very diverse. You may particularly go out there and look for the difficult patients because you can learn a lot from that. But if you choose to go that route, he continued, you may well find yourself at a commercial disadvantage. Patients were disadvantaged as well, especially those who were considered difficult cases. A woman in her late 30s, for example, may have looked at the rankings and chosen a clinic with a high success rate, not knowing that the clinic wouldn't be interested in taking her on as a patient. Worse, she may have avoided a clinic with a low success rate, even though that clinic may have specialised in difficult cases such as hers. This is just one textbook example of good intentions gone bad. The government was keen to measure IVF clinics, but these measures were imperfect representations of a clinic's success and what consumers really wanted to know. And, as is often the case, once officials began measuring things, clinics began optimising for the measures, success rates, rather than the real thing, performance with all cases. Unsurprisingly, this system had harmful effects on the patients and the clinics that didn't practice selection at the gate. But the biggest victim may come as a surprise. As my colleague Mihaela Stan and I discovered while researching the IVF industry, the practice probably did the most harm to the clinics that accepted easy cases. You heard that right. After an initial surge of success, the clinics that tried to game the system ended up performing worse in the long run than their ethos-driven competitors. Why? The learning curve. Learning by doing. The learning curve is a well-known phenomenon in management research. It shows that organisations pretty much automatically get better at what they produce. For example, as Boeing built more and more 737s, the process became easier and less expensive as time went on. Researchers have conducted such learning curve studies in many industries. I have seen studies on airplanes, cars, bottles, pizzas, and so on. And, as Stan and I discovered, the learning curve applied to IVF clinics as well. Figure 1.1 displays the learning curves of the clinics that treated mostly good prognosis patients, labelled high selection at the gate, and of the clinics that also admitted a lot of poor prognosis patients, low selection at the gate. The vertical axis is the success rate, and the horizontal axis displays the clinic's experience. As you can see, on the left side of figure 1.1, as discussed, the clinics that admitted poor prognosis patients did much worse in terms of their success rate than the clinics that mostly treated easy cases at first. But you'll notice that selection at the gate had another effect that clinics hadn't anticipated. The success rate of those clinics increased a bit with experience, but not a whole lot, as shown by the almost horizontal line of the graph. The clinics that treated a lot of poor prognosis patients, on the other hand, witnessed a sharp rise in their success rate. Their learning curve is steep. It is so steep that after a year or so, the lines cross, and the clinics that treated quite a lot of poor prognosis patients actually started to display higher success rates than the clinics that thought they were being clever by treating good prognosis patients only. The clinics that did admit poor prognosis patients ended up doing significantly better in terms of their success rates, in spite of performing the procedure on a lot of poor prognosis patients. Clearly, in the end, the good guys won. Clinics learn a lot from poor prognosis cases. Figuring out how to help women who have a complicated etiology get pregnant leads to deeper knowledge, better communication patterns between specialists, and new innovative procedures. Because of that, doctors were also able to use their new insights to improve standard cases as well. The rankings-driven clinics aren't an anomaly. Organisations in every industry are harming themselves because of the best practices they've adopted and continue to use. The good news, as I'll explore throughout this book, is that it's possible to identify these practices and kill them. By doing so, you can reduce harm, learn more, and eliminate inefficiencies. And, more important, by killing a bad practice and not blindly following what your competitors are doing, you can gain a competitive edge and create a profitable source of renewal and innovation. I'll explain all of that in more detail as we progress through the book. But first, let's explore how bad practices are created, why they persist, and how they are negatively affecting your business in subtle but pernicious ways. Best bad practices. Every organization follows a series of best practices, formal or informal rules of behavior that its employees have learned and passed along through the years. These include formalized management techniques, such as ISO 9000, Total Quality Management, and Six Sigma. Traits of organizational culture, such as the practice of working long hours in many corporate finance divisions in the banking industry, and various types of strategic choices, including which activities are performed and which are not. In some cases, best practices live up to their name. They make our organizations faster, more efficient, and more competitive. For instance, the use of key performance indicators, in which a company systematically collects, analyzes, and communicates a set of performance metrics, helps firms to improve their productivity. Making promotion decisions based on merit surely is a helpful practice and beats simple tenure-based promotions. Similarly, conducting a cultural assessment increases the odds of successfully integrating an acquisition. Few would disagree that these represent good management practices. But this isn't always the case. Some best practices are, in fact, inefficient. Some are stupid, and some are plain harmful. Medical staff and administrators chase success rates. Financial and consulting firms still demand long hours from their employees, even when their demands lead to reduced productivity owing to overstress and burnout. And many pharmaceutical firms still spend billions on direct sales promotions for their blockbuster drugs, in spite of the practice's proven ineffectiveness. These so-called best practices, and countless others, prevent our organizations from creating new sources of innovation. Examples of suspected bad practices are easy to find. All you need to do is look around in your own organization. Maybe it's the way your HR department handles performance reviews, or how budgets are allocated, or maybe it's your bonus system, the way your company assesses project proposals, or some other process that is too cumbersome or outdated. With rare exceptions, managers do not willingly design and adopt harmful practices. Sure, sometimes self-interested managers do bad things, but I would argue that it's much more commonplace for good managers to inadvertently create something bad, which, if you think about it, is more worrisome. It would be easier to dismiss the leadership of the IVF clinics that adopted the practice of selection at the gate as stupid or evil, but that wasn't the case. They genuinely thought that what they were doing made commercial sense, and it did, at first. And because of the short-term benefits, which appeared quickly and were easy to see, the practice of selection at the gate spread. Once one clinic started the practice, and it became associated with success, others followed suit. And because they didn't foresee the long-term consequences, they continued with the practice. The first reason that organizations follow bad practices is that we tend to believe in a Darwinian view of management. We believe that competition weeds out bad practices and props up the best ones. Therefore, we believe that the most successful firms must be following the best management practices, while unsuccessful firms are not. And, since those best practices help firms perform better, those are the ones that thrive and survive and gradually take over. This isn't always true. Great companies aren't infallible. They make mistakes too, and their processes and strategies can be just as inefficient and harmful as others. Second, organizations adopt bad practices because it enhances their legitimacy, as economic sociologists call it. Companies are obliged to adopt or continue to follow a best practice because it is an industry norm, and if they choose not to follow it, investors, customers and competitors will frown upon it. For example, despite a retail chain's reservations about cultural differences, local competition and supplier issues, it may feel pressure to enter the Chinese market because all of its competitors have done so and it seems like the legitimate thing to do. This is the same reason why a champagne maker may locate its operations in one of the traditional villages of Champagne rather than near Paris, or why a management consulting firm chooses to adopt a traditional partnership structure instead of a more progressive model. Even though these options may be less economically feasible, they feel beholden to tradition. It's good optics, but it's not necessarily good business. The third reason is as simple as it is frustrating. Sometimes we carry on with bad practices because that's the way it's always been done in our organisations. We side with the past and don't think twice about it. Most of the time, these practices don't start off as bad, but over time, as the organisation or its competitive landscape changes, the practice becomes unsuitable. But no one questions it, because we see its longevity as a sure sign of its continuing success. Bad practices wouldn't be as much of a problem if our organisations were quick to change and adapt, but they aren't. Once adopted, a bad practice is hard to identify and often refuses to quit, and like a virus, it begins to spread to other organisations. How does this happen? An unholy trinity. Three key conditions, in combination, make a detrimental management practice persist. 1. The practice is associated with success, as we briefly touched on earlier. 2. There is causal ambiguity in the industry. 3. The practice spreads more quickly than it kills. Let's look at each of these conditions while returning to IVF clinics. Condition 1. Association with success. In order for a bad practice to take hold and become popular, it has to be associated with success in some way. This usually happens when an organisation sees short-term results after its implementation, something we saw with IVF clinics. Many firms in the IVF industry firmly and persistently believed that selection at the gate was a smart thing to do because it did lead to an increase in a clinic's success rate. So why mess with a good thing? Moreover, more clinics began adopting the process when they saw a competitor's success rate go up. They were convinced that it was a helpful practice, hence short-term success, even if outweighed by harmful long-term consequences, is one way that a bad practice becomes associated with an erroneous perception of success. There are various ways that a harmful practice can become associated with success, and boosting short-term performance is only one of them. In the next chapter, we'll dive into the rest. Condition 2. Causal ambiguity. The second condition that needs to be in place for a bad or suboptimal practice to persist is causal ambiguity. In other words, people in the industry must not fully understand the practice's true long-term consequences. This situation is what we witness in IVF too. Whether a clinic is in trouble may be completely unambiguous. Whether its success rate is lagging and the clinic is not innovative enough are usually quite evident to the organisation's leadership. What is ambiguous is the connection between cause and effect, that the practice of selection at the gate, the cause, is hurting the organisation's long-term success rate, its effect. That is because IVF is not a simple process. Even for standard cases, 7 of 10 treatments fail. It's also because the harmful effects, a lack of opportunities for learning and innovation in the clinic, are soft and fluffy things, not hard factors that can be put into a spreadsheet and analysed by hitting enter. Soft and fluffy things, innovation, learning, people, are often poorly understood in terms of their management, but are very consequential for organisations' long-term success. A harmful practice feeds on causal ambiguity. It needs it to survive. Condition 3. Spreads quicker than it kills. The third condition for a harmful practice to thrive is that it needs to be simple. Simple enough to be adopted easily by organisations in the industry, incumbents and entrants alike. Take note, a harmful practice is hardly ever a complex practice. Complex practices spread only with difficulty, and, just as a virus must hop quite swiftly from one person to the next to survive, a bad management practice must hop easily from one firm to another. In the IVF industry, selection at the gate is easy to adopt. It merely involves observing some simple patient demographics, for example, age, background information, for example, whether the patient has often failed treatment before, and a battery of standard tests, for example, on ovarian reserve. Consequently, other clinics imitate it easily, and the bad practice reproduces. Swift diffusion is fostered by other factors too, including industry characteristics, such as a homogeneous and dense population of firms, as in the IVF industry, but it is insufficient by itself. The rate of diffusion also needs to be high relative to the rate at which the practice deteriorates adopting firms. Think about it. A virus can only survive if it spreads quicker than it kills its host, that is, if it hops onto other people before the original host succumbs. That's true for organisations too. Just as a highly lethal virus that kills almost instantaneously cannot survive because it will die with its host before it has been able to infect anyone else, harmful practices are also never highly toxic. If a practice were to put a firm at a huge competitive disadvantage from its onset, it would swiftly die out with that firm. Harmful practices are much sneakier. They weaken a firm just a little bit, wearing it out gradually over the long run. Each one of these three conditions needs to be present for bad practices to be able to exist. When they occur in combination, the effects are truly troublesome, making a harmful practice persist, roving further afield and weakening its hosts. Yet these conditions are quite common. Practices often have different consequences in the long run than in the short run, and there are many other reasons why a practice can be erroneously associated with success. Causal ambiguity is commonplace in most industries, where change is almost constant and many factors can influence firm performance. Similarly, exchanges of personnel, imitation of each other's practices and decisions through benchmarking exercises, and the use of consultants and other advisers, all of which stimulate the diffusion of a practice, are the norm in most businesses rather than the exception. Thus, bad practices are prevalent and prevail. Here lies the opportunity. Before we move forward into part one of the book, I want to reiterate an important point. Yes, some best practices are harmful and inefficient, as I'll continue to describe in detail, and yes, killing them will eliminate their harmful effects and inefficiencies. But the main point I want to get across is that killing bad practices can open up new avenues for growth and innovation, and reinvigorate your business. That's really what this book is about. Low-cost airlines, such as Southwest, for example, have attracted new consumers, many of whom would have travelled by car, train or bus, by eliminating in-flight meals and other amenities that traditional airlines were convinced people wanted. By eliminating these bad practices, Southwest and others were able to lure new customers to their airlines with lower prices. In part two and throughout the book, I'll touch on other examples, including how The Independent increased its circulation by printing its newspaper on smaller pages. We'll also explore how businesses have made killing best practices the central part of their business model. The founders of Citizen M avoided most of the trappings of mid-range hotels, and Eden McCallum, a management consulting firm, was able to attract top talent by hiring all of its consultants on a per-project, freelance basis. In part three, I'll lay out a more long-term strategy for building organisations that seek to change and renew themselves continually, which will drastically reduce the possibilities of bad practices emerging and doing further harm to businesses. But first, in part one, I want to circle back to the origins of bad management practices and dive deeper into the three conditions that enable them to breed and persist. Part 1. How bad practices prevail. Chapter 1. We're suckers for success. At the end of World War II, in 1945, the Japanese economy was devastated. Industrial areas were destroyed in almost all major cities. Transportation networks were severely damaged. A quarter of Japan's national wealth was annihilated, and more than 2 million people in its workforce were killed. The country's population suffered for a decade. Yet, by the 1960s, Japan's economy started growing rapidly and unabatedly. In what became known as Japan's economic miracle, it quickly rose to become the second largest economy in the world, where in 1965, Japan's gross domestic product stood at about $90 billion. By 1980, it had increased to over $1 trillion. Much of this was achieved through exports. Japanese car manufacturers, for example, were outcompeting the traditional Western brands in their home markets. Japanese cars, such as Toyota, Honda, and Mitsubishi, were more affordable but also of significantly higher quality. American car manufacturers, among others, were eager to learn how the Japanese companies managed to achieve this. A large part of their success could be ascribed to a set of new management practices referred to as Total Quality Management, TQM. In the 1950s, Americans W. Edwards Deming and Joseph Juran had gone to Japan to lecture on quality management, and their views concurred with those of local management professor Kaoru Ishikawa. TQM, as the practices they advocated became widely known, prescribed how all aspects of an organization should be committed to delivering quality, not only top to bottom within the organization, but also start to finish in the entire product life cycle. The core components of TQM. Worker involvement. Whereas in most companies, management and engineers organized and controlled the production process, while line employees were merely expected to execute their prescribed tasks, TQM advocated much greater involvement of ordinary workers in the organization of the process. Top management's responsibility. Senior management's foremost task was to create an environment in which workers would feel safe and able to contribute and improve the functioning of the organization. Managers should remove all organizational systems that create fear, such as punishment for poor performance or appraisal systems that explicitly ranked employees. Intrinsic motivation. TQM assumed that employees have an intrinsic motivation to perform their tasks well, that they enjoy the feeling of accomplishment, and that they are motivated to contribute to the prosperity of the organization. The assumption resulted, for instance, in relying on self-managed work teams as a form of empowerment. Cross-functional solutions. Since organizations are systems of interdependent parts, TQM advocated for ad hoc cross-functional teams that could identify and solve quality problems. Other permanent cross-functional teams were then responsible for the improvement of processes over the long term. Evidence-driven decisions. Frontline employees are the ones who should analyze and control processes. TQM also advocated for the use of systematic data collection, statistics, and testing solutions by experiment to solve problems and generate process improvements, rather than relying on impressions and conjectures. Continuous improvement. On top of that, organizations should constantly collect and analyze data in order to improve the accuracy of conclusions, aid consensus and decision-making, and allow for predictions based on past data. In the TQM view, quality improvement should be treated as a never-ending quest involving all employees in the organization. Customer and supplier relationships. Finally, creating quality was thought to transcend the boundaries of the organization and should be determined by the requirements of customers. Moreover, companies should establish long-term supplier partnerships rather than engage in ad hoc transactions. Thus, TQM was a comprehensive management approach that involved all stakeholders in an organization. Overall, TQM required a long-term, cooperative, and comprehensive approach to doing business. In order to be successful, organizations needed to continuously improve their processes and deliver high-quality products and services that were useful to customers. By doing so, they would grow and gain market share while uniting employees.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?